Hello and welcome to Q&A Quest episode 375. I'm your host, Mike Veilguard Apps, and with me as always,
Rook of the podcast, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And brought to you by his school having Culture Day preparations instead of class today, your man in Japan, Michael Baker, Gaijin Minogatari.
How's Culture Day going? Is it cultured?
It is cultured.
Hooray! Oh,
3 months of subbing, Fireminer, thank you.
Thanks for the sub, Fireminer.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you.
So, what you been playing, Gaijin?
What do you think?
Romancing Saga 2?
Yes.
On Super Famicom!
Not this time!
Not this time.
No, I'm curious to hear your thoughts a lot, because you have much more experience with the original than I do.
We'll just start asking away, Wheels. I'm not sure where to begin.
Do you like it?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It's a good remake of a good game.
Yes. See, what other questions might I have? Do you think the battle system has improved over the original?
Well, it's definitely shifted. As, like, the original was, you set everyone's turn for the round, and then it happens.
Very old-school Dragon Quest-style RPG.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just general, I mean, turn-based before active time battle became a standard. And this one's a timeline situation, so it feels actually a bit more like Final Fantasy X in that respect. Or Chained Echoes, for that matter. For a more recent example. It's different. It's not any better or worse, generally. Having the point pools for weapon and spells merged is different. But, I mean, not too bad. I mean, from what I can recall, the actual totals are still higher than they used to be for the original game.
Magic and Waza, you say?
I wasn't actually looking at any information before going into this game, so I was just kind of assuming that they would borrow from, like, Minstrel Song and do the battle points that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't expecting them to actually have more of a Final Fantasy, old Final Fantasy style resource management as a necessity. So, and it's interesting that they've organized the actual tech point thing is more obviously experience than it used to be. Is that that used to be pretty well hidden in the game mechanics.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the remake that's been surfaced that used to be largely opaque.
Yeah.
But hey, you can make it opaque if you want.
Yeah, if that's how you want to play.
Yeah, but I kind of miss the victory poses whenever somebody gained a point in something. I mean, even Emerald Beyond has that, and everyone clapping.
In my mind, I'm seeing, like, fucking Saga Frontier characters jumping up and sort of spinning, and then, like...
That's exactly what they would
back
do.
And forth.
That's almost, I mean, jump around, spin, and strike a pose. That's how it works.
Yep. Bit of a shame to lose that. I mean, it's a very attractive game overall, though.
Yeah.
They've really been impressed with all the different areas in the game. They're really nice.
I'm impressed that they have so faithfully translated so much of the original game's bestiary into something reasonably good looking.
Yeah, I was shocked when I looked at, like, some of the original artwork, especially the heroes, and it's just like, oh, they perfectly brought them into 3D. This is like...
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
I didn't even know how Kaczynski was supposed to work in three dimensions, and yet here we are.
even like the little bunny guys in the first or second dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a difference here. Since in the original game, a lot of enemy types for any given area, what you actually fought was highly dependent on your battle ranking.
Mm-hmm.
So actual enemy makeup would vary quite a bit through the area, but here it looks like they actually have set enemy types, set of enemies for each area, and their stats go up with battle rank instead of...
They have a battle rank, basically, as opposed to swapping out enemies based on battle rank.
Yeah, so that's actually a bit more like Final Fantasy VIII.
A little bit.
Yeah. I mean, just to draw a comparison in one way.
But less evil, somehow.
Well, I mean, less easily abused. In evil. Both directions. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, the goblins, they look exactly like the original sprites, except 3D. The bunny guys, same thing. All of the bosses, same thing. Actually, wait a minute. The Vicar, or characters like the Vicar or Seyfried actually look like humans. So, they're actual characters now instead of just semi-nameless bad guy NPCs. So, again, yeah, plot presentation has... The plot's not actually any different, it's just the presentation is amazing.
Yeah, have you gotten to one of the sequences where you, like, see a vision of the past?
I've gotten about 4 of those so far.
Okay. Is that new?
That is completely new.
Yeah, that's okay. New.
That's completely new. And I want to say it's not completely congruous with what I remember of the old deep lore, but back 20 to 25 years ago, we were still making do with, like, fan scanlations of old articles and game guides and things, and so I'm not quite sure how much of what we thought was canon back then was actually accurate either.
How much was just someone lying and saying something existed in a book?
Yeah. No, I mean, some of the things are pretty accurate, like there was the background assumption that, like, Wagnus was a politician and Kaczynski was an assassin and Subie was an adventurer type and Noelle was a champion. Antark's characterization is quite a bit different from what we had imagined originally, but yeah, I'm not sure how much of this is the fact that we were extremely limited on what we knew back then, and how much of it is the lore has expanded in the remaster and in things like Imperial Saga adding things in. It's also, I don't remember the termites being this big a plot element. They were just kind of a thing that was occasionally invading. I don't remember them being the actual reason for the societal collapse. So.
You learned an ability, perennial victim, more easily targeted by enemies.
That's great if you're building a counterattack build.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose I can throw that on my shieldy guy.
So did you spark charm immunity?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Learned a new ability, all attributes plus +1.
That's a pretty good ability, I'm going to be real with you.
No,
I
switched back to Romancing Saga.
Okay, I was like...
Romancing Saga.
But, oh yeah... Yeah, so did you go with the Emperor or Empress for your final?
Empress.
Empo?
Generally the better choice considering exactly what kind of things the final boss can throw at you.
Before we get to what me and Wales have been playing, I'll hit this question the Fire Miner's been putting in the chat. Are we sure that Xenoblade X Definitive will be a Switch 1 game? Yes. Just with what games will the Switch 2 launch? Probably stuff they haven't, it's not going to launch with a port, I'll put it that way.
I mean, I pre-ordered a Xenoblade Chronicles X Switch cart, so if it would be very confused if it's not a Switch 1 game.
Yeah, the way I'll put it is that, at most it might be a situation where, oh, if you play it on Switch 2, it will be enhanced.
Yeah.
But, they're not stealth announcing Switch 2 games at this point. It's not really Nintendo style. And after all, we've seen, like, it looks nicer than the Wii U version, but it doesn't look completely out of step with the Wii U version. If they were going to be, like, announcing a Switch 2 Xenoblade X remaster, they would be going to great lengths to make sure that it looks like it blows the original version out of the water. Yeah, realistically, I think the best guess for what Switch 2 will launch with is stuff that the Mario team has been making, since they haven't put out anything since like that like random bit of DLC for Odyssey in like 2019. I would suspect that is the linchpin launch title that they're focused on.
I mean, that's generally a safe bet with Nintendo. It's like they want to launch with their big series.
Yeah, like they try to launch with at least one of their like marquee franchises. I would suspect that within the first like 6 months of the Switch successor, there will be a new 3D Mario, and there will be a like Mario Kart 9 or whatever they end up calling it. Like, I would suspect both of those. And like, that makes sense. Mario's big. 3D Mario sells to hardcore fans. It's good for early adopters. It's still a mass appeal title, but I mean, like, 3D Mario never sells as well as 2D Mario does. But, that's why you put Super Mario Wonder on the Switch while, like, the 3D Mario team's project shows up on Switch 2, because early adopters are much more likely to buy a 3D Mario than a 2D Mario. But, like, otherwise, like, I'm sure there's a portion of, like, Monolith is huge, and I'm sure that, like, Xenoblade X is not the only thing that Definitive is not the only thing they're working on. I'm not sure how far we are from that coming out, but I suspect that that's, you know, well into the works. I'm trying to think of, like, which of their studios is just, like, unaccounted for.
Yeah, I mean, as far as launch stuff too, I'm sure there's going to be some random ports as well.
Yeah, there'll be random ports, especially from third parties who will be like excited to have an excuse to like wring more cash out of their PS4 catalogs.
I guarantee you there will be a game from Ubisoft at Switch 2 launch.
There will be a couple of probably several Assassin's Creed games.
Yeah.
Realistically, I would throw out probably Persona 3 Reload, Metaphor ReFantasio, or like if they're really feeling gutsy, possibly both. Let's see. What I think for Square. Because I'm sure Square will have something.
I can think of a few things for Square.
Yeah.
One of them I just popped into my head and I want to delete it from my brain now.
Did you think FF16?
Yes.
That wouldn't surprise me too much. Maybe FF7 Remake.
Yeah.
Depending upon whether that's like loosed from captivity at this stage or not. But yeah, like that one, neither of those would surprise me. Might see like one of the Resident Evil remakes from Capcom.
That would be cool.
That's like a non-cloud version. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that, like, I'm sure third parties will be happy to, like I said, trot out their PS4 games, because it's just like, hey, here's a way to release, you know, this catalog of expensive games that took a long time to develop that we could get a lot of, like, porting is not a zero cost, but it's a much lower cost than making a new game. Hmm. And you can sell it to an audience that is largely composed of people who didn't have the hardware to play the old one. So.
Yep. Yep.
Will the mecha game renaissance continue into 2026? I mean, we haven't, like, you mentioned 2025 being packed, but, like, I would imagine, like, you know, 2026 is far enough out that I can't even imagine thinking too hard about it. Like, let's wait and see that some of those 2025 games don't turn into 2026 games first.
One-shotting sandworms. Booyah.
Ooh-yah.
Ooh-yah? Remember the ooh-yah?
No. Why?
Just to hurt you. Just to hurt you.
Fucking ooh-yah. 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 Whatever. I don't care. I'm not going to pronounce it right.
We don't care enough to pronounce it right.
When will Daemon X Machina will get a launch date?
Titanic Scion. I was just thinking about that. Like, did we get any information about that other than that it exists since it was revealed? I don't even know if they ever admitted what platforms it was on.
Do we call Xenoblade X a mech game? It takes an awful fucking long time for you to get your mech in that game.
I would still call it a mech game.
Okay.
Like, you can fly around on those damn things. Like, the mech's an awesome, important part of the game. Yeah.
I've already started listening to that soundtrack again. It's so good.
Oh, yeah, and the R-Type Tactics remaster. Oh, man. The people demand Operation Bitter Chocolate.
I'm going to play that eventually just to, you know, balance the accounts here. But when is it coming out?
I think it's been pushed into 2025.
It's just a long term eventually.
Yeah, it's been one of those things that's just like sat around waiting to come out for what feels like forever. Yeah, it's just NIS America has it listed for 2025. I don't know if it's coming out sooner in Japan, but at least in America, it's 2025. And of course, they have a fancy pants edition for it.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
They like money!
Fortunately, it seems like the fanciest edition is PS5 only, but I'm not playing a full goddamn tactics game on a PS5. No thanks. Two full tactics RPGs that were originally designed for a PSP.
Yeah. Oh, random aside involving PS5. I was listening to some podcasts, and they were talking about the top-selling games, retail games, for September. Number two was Astrobot. Above Madden.
Little Astrobot.
Above Madden, yeah.
I assume Madden launched in August?
Yes.
Okay, that explains it.
That's still impressive,
doing well for itself.
Yeah. So here's hoping Astrobot 2.
I mean, that's almost inevitable.
I would hope so.
There now, the Astrobot factory. They'll probably produce games a lot more often than whatever, like, AAA said that game is taking 5 years, 6 years, 7 years.
The Last of Us 3. The Last of Us
Part 3, baby! I love that they, like, You can sense a certain kind of, like, desperation to justify oneself when you go with, like, part two, because it implies that the original tale is retroactively incomplete.
Just ridiculous.
Especially when they went back and retitled the original Part 1.
Oh, God, vomit. Game does not need a sequel. Fuck's sake.
Several sequels.
I mean, that has never stopped anybody from giving a game a sequel.
I know.
Unfortunately, the bad problem is when you finish the sequel and everyone's like, that game didn't need a sequel.
Naughty Dog.
Your sequel is your ultimate argument for its own existence.
Naughty Dog used to make games that make you feel happy.
Occasionally, you would listen to fucking Nathan Drake Bandicoot playing some weird bastardized version of Crash Bandicoot. I say because like it has a weird interface. I don't know what's going on. The UI. The UI.
I'm both glad that
DUI was arrested for DUI. Okay.
I'm glad that, very glad they made Uncharted 4, because Uncharted 3 would have been a giant turd of a way to end that series.
Harsh.
I mean, that game, the game's not bad. It just kind of ends with a, it's got like a nothing ending.
It doesn't feel like a conclusion is what you're getting at.
Yes. Four is like this perfect conclusion. So don't fucking make us looking at the, I'm talking they to made you right now, one. Sony. I know that, but don't make a sequel with Nathan Drake. Continue the series. Put someone else in there.
I'm going to be real with you. I don't like the issue you're going to run into is that Naughty Dog isn't capable of making two AAA games at once. And they're making Last of Us Part 3.
Oh, God, why?
At this point, you can probably blame, like, HBO. As much as anything.
That's true. Fuck you, Time Warner, and your bullshit.
Do you think that Vampire Survivors provides the perfect type of low-budget model that indie studios can copy? I mean, I've seen several do it, and also it was an indie game.
I would say, in my opinion, no. No.
Like, it's one of those things that, like, it's going to just sort of continue to be a staple of indie games, the Vampire Survivors style game. I don't know that there's any such thing as like a perfect blueprint to copy, because it's just like, you know, you just saturate the market when everyone thinks that. But there's probably room for that formula to
expand. Everyone saturates the market when everyone thinks that. It's like, it's kind of the way the cycle goes.
Yeah. But really, I'm just saying that, like, I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question, basically. But. Mm. Yeah, it's I suspect there's probably still more ways that that formula can be expanded upon, so I'm not exactly terribly perturbed at the number that seemed to exist at the moment. But, you know, I'm also not like a connoisseur of the genre. I think I've watched someone play Vampire Survivors and thought, that's neat. Not enough that I want to play it, but it's neat.
It is neat. I don't know that there's a lot you can add on to it, so it just kind of feels like...
I'm sure there's probably ways to do it. We'll let the collective machine see what hammers out of it. Man, I wish I was playing Dragon Age right now. This is what podcasts do to a man.
I'm so sorry.
It's your fault.
We can talk about romance.
I was talking in the context of Temtem and how much its own fans complained about the developers divesting from the main game because they thought the MMO Temtem wasn't profitable. I mean, a lot of MMOs aren't profitable. That's just sort of what happens.
That's why most MMOs are not on a subscription model, or like a premium model, or freemium model. Yeah.
There's the as it turns out, the most of the time, you'll get a lot more from a handful of people who are willing to spend essentially unlimited amounts of money.
But you have to make a situation where they are happy to stay there and spend lots of money.
I'm reminded of, now that I'm thinking about BioWare, a story I once heard about the the Mass Effect 3 multiplayer, which was basically like, it was a success in the sense that it did, like, it made people played it. It was fairly popular. But it was seen as, like, a missed opportunity because there was actually a relatively low ceiling about how much you could feasibly spend on the Mass Effect 3 multiplayer. Like, I think maxing out, like, all of the characters would run you, like, $300, which is a lot of money. But in, like, free-to-play whaling territory, it is, like, zero money. So there was, like, just this in internal belief, especially at EA, that there's, like, room for more monetization. And, like, BioWare, of course, wanted a stream of money that they could point out to EA and say, see, we make money just fine. You don't need to cut into us again. So for, like, Dragon Age 3, they built, like, a multiplayer mode that theoretically you could spend thousands and thousands of dollars on, but, like, no one fucking played Dragon Age 3 multiplayer. There's a pretty good chance you didn't realize that it existed.
I forgot that was a thing.
Yep. They tried not to highlight it, actually, in press because of fear of backlash, and so ultimately very few people seemed to even know that mode existed. What's the reason for people to stick with WoW and League of Legends while constantly complaining about them? People are creatures of habit. Even if you don't like something, you'll if it's part of your routine, you'll keep doing it until, like, it becomes egregiously, like, a factor of misery in your life.
I think that's part of it. I can speak from experience in dealing with stupid Destiny players. I'm just like, they're having fun. They've just gotten into some
their method
cycle
of having fun is a nightmare.
No, I think, like, a lot of these people actually enjoy the game. I mean, they play it all the time, but they've just gotten into some weird cycle of, oh, the game is in a bad state and it needs to...
The only way I can fix that is by being the shittiest human alive.
Yes, and this is perpetuated by content creators who constantly have to make videos about what's wrong with Destiny? How can they fix Destiny? Meanwhile,
the other thing I would say about that is that any human being who has to make content about a game basically every day is going to rapidly resent that video game and every idiosyncrasy of it.
Yes, and I feel like that kind of ends up bleeding into the regular people that actually play the game, and no one stops and looks at it and says, hey, if you compare Destiny now to where it was in, like, year one, where it was a steaming pile of shit, this is a fantastic game with tons of content that can consume your life. What the fuck are you people complaining about?
Like, the ultimate this, thing...
This just in, newsflash, Destiny's no longer a steaming pile of crap.
Like, the ultimate thing that you end up with is that, like, there's this weird desire among a certain set for, like, to find games that are just like, this is the only game I play. Like, I don't, like, video games aren't my hobby. This one thing is my hobby. And the answer is that's kind of like, to have that as the one thing you do as a hobby most days is, like, very few hobbies stand up to that concept. Like, even if, like, let's say your hobby is, like, rec league sports, that's a game a week and, like, practice every few days. Like, that's, you know, it is not your every night hobby. But a lot of people will take these like live service games and it's like, oh, this is my every night hobby. Like every night I jump in and I hop on for a couple hours. And nothing stands up to that. Nothing can stand up to that. Like eventually you're going to, like, if you're doing that, you're going to rapidly run out of completely unique content. You're going to have to be willing to accept doing content that you have done before. Like, that's just the way of the world. It's one of those things, like, I'm reminded of one of my favorite Futurama jokes. It took an hour to write. I thought it would take an hour to read. like, just this, you know, the creation process is just inherently slower than the consumption process. There's no getting around that. You're going to run out of content. You're going to run out of new content. You're going to have to accept doing old content. You're going to get so familiar with the old content that at some point, there's a decent chance that if you don't keep perspective, you're going to start resenting aspects of the old content because you just know it too well. Like, you're going to, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. Like, you're going to, like, repeatedly rub up against aspects of the community you don't like. Like, these are all just aspects of, like, this is why, you know, a lot, you know, my hobby is, let's say that I, you know, that your hobby is reading. Typically, your hobby of reading is not the same book over and over. I'm not saying no one does that, but I am saying it's unusual.
I have known people who reread, like, the same book, like, once a year or more.
Yeah, but even once a year is still, like, extreme qualitative difference than compared to, like, you know, I do this every night. Like, if my hobby was just reading the same book every night over and over, or even the same series, it would still, like, eventually I would start finding things that just, like, pissed me off about it. Because it's just, like, I don't have time to appreciate it from the perspective of, like, finding new things to enjoy or, like, re-finding the things that I enjoyed in the first place, because I've never looked away from them. But more and more, my vision is blocked out by the things that are just pissing me off. And that's the difficulty of the live service game. Like, you end up with this kind of player that just doesn't know what to do with himself. If they're not playing this stuff over and over. Let's see. What's this other one? Why does discourse on Twitter right now? Oh god. As I walk through videos on YouTube become rarer as their makers find out that they can't compete with Rage Bait videos from anti-woke people who don't even play the game. I mean, like, the algorithms optimize for, like, here's the thing. A walkthrough video is for people who are playing the game. And a Rage Bait video is for people who aren't. And no matter how big the game is, the audience of people who aren't playing it is larger than the audience of people who are. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't even think it's healthy for YouTube long term. I think ultimately that becomes bad for them over time, as eventually people are just like, I don't feel like going into the machine that pisses me off. But, you know, that takes a while. And when you're just showing, like, quarterly watch times are up, you tune your algorithm for, I am so angry at video game for reason. And, like, you know, we see it, you know, once every week at this stage. Like, it took me a second to realize how much that Brigade was, like, absolutely knives out for Dragon Age 4. Like, wildly, like, just ready to tear into it because it has trans people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
your parents don't put Fox News in the background.
I say, fuck you.
Yeah. Go fuck off.
No, a really fun one that came up.
We don't want you in our audience.
No.
A fun one that came up the other day was apparently a Steam review for Romancing Saga 2.
Mm-hmm.
Describing it as a woke mess and go back to RE Fantasio instead. And everybody on the Saga subreddit was like, we're not even sure this has to be a troll. This has to be some idiot trying to troll us in the worst, in the most ridiculous possible way, right?
Yeah, I don't know how that can't be a real... Okay, I don't get to have the confidence in saying that can't be a real person. I can't imagine how it's a real person. Mm-hmm. But, good lord. I mean, fucking metaphor is not subtle.
No. And it's like, nobody's quite sure what they have against Romancing Saga 2 either.
Yeah, it is confusing from every direction. It's fascinating.
But since the usual philosophy for the anti-woke crowd appears to be anything made after 2010 is crap, we could go over the minute details of difference between this and the original, but it's still pretty much the same game. We're like, no one's sure what the hell they're talking about here.
Yeah.
But it's funny in its own way.
Yeah. Fireminer saying a lot of rage bait content is consumed ambiently by people who want white noise. If that's true of you, I beg of you to go look up like content where someone just describes like how a speedrun works or something, because that's much more neutral content that doesn't involve people screaming.
I mean, like, during the pandemic, I just picked up watching Among Us play videos just because it's funnier than most sitcoms.
Oh, those are pretty funny, actually.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
It's very easy to cut together.
Highlight. you find a good group to follow, and it's just like the parasocial instincts check in, and suddenly you're just watching this sitcom version of Umineko. Where it's just, yeah, it's the same group of people over and over and over again, and you're never exactly sure which characters they're actually playing this time. It's funny. But otherwise, recently I was watching, this one guy who does Dwarf Fortress videos, and...
Oh, yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun.
Playthroughs ended it up to give these, just, like, these ridiculous emergent narratives that he's narrating along with whatever happens to the game. And it's like, I've tried this game before. It is certainly not for me, but it is really funny to just listen in while I'm doing laundry.
One of my favorite people to listen to just in the background, since I guess we're just recommending good things to listen to on YouTube, is I've recommended this channel before, but it's called Warlocracy, and it's this very Eastern Bloc sounding man just describing like emergent storytelling that comes out of things like Fallout. It's very soothing.
My favorite genre right now on YouTube is professional music guy explains why your favorite video game music tracks are the shit.
Like, this is why this is so cool.
Yeah. I guess I've shared a few of those with you.
Yeah. I was watching one today. It was like some former opera singer who now does this and voice acting.
Oh, that's cool.
Listening to a song from Xenoblade Chronicles X. And that was fun. We are in trouble. Like, explaining all the different elements. I think I shared one recently about someone analyzing the metaphor battle theme. It's pretty fun. So if you need white noise on YouTube, you should look up stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Please, anything else?
Also, I loved finding out that the fucking the lyrics to the metaphor battle theme, like, I couldn't make out any of them, so I just sort of assumed that they were Latin. No, they're Esperanto.
Oh.
I mean, which, granted, if you're not familiar with the other language, they do kind of sound similar.
Yeah, and perfectly fitting, given what the game is about.
Yeah. It's like, okay, Esperanto, that's an interesting choice here.
Yeah, but like, you just get to hear this like this weird dude just like shouting shit in Esperanto, and he's like fucking pumped. It's great. But I appreciate that. That choice is clever, because it's like, oh, it's something that is like, it's real, but it's fantastical in the sense that it is a language that no one speaks natively. My favorite genre.
Speaking of other differences with Romancing Saga 2.
Yeah.
I've been interested in how the game kind of shows you where, or like when new glimmers are possible.
Yes.
But it's at the same time, it's only showing. It's like it's not showing that it will happen. It's just showing like an increasing probability. But you can still glimmer the things without the light bulb on the menu. Because I just got Mach Blade. There was no sign that there was anything learnable here. It just happened. I'm like, this is nice.
Yeah, I think
it's a useful way to like help people who don't like who get distracted by like glimmering being entirely random. It like focuses their attention.
Yeah.
But it's good that it's not the only time you can glimmer.
I mean, it's not entirely random. It's just so dependent on like half a dozen different variables.
Say random, I mean near enough random. Like, things you can't control for.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm glad you
I still remember the original game. In the original game, I got Arraj shot on Therese, the first ranger character, in the goblin lair before Kazinsi.
Nice.
And this is the original game. This technique costs 11 Waza points. She had 17 total. And it didn't do that much more damage than random shot. Because her skill level and her equipment were so low.
Like, it would be really good much later in the game.
It was like, okay, this is nice to have for later. But as it is, it's like, I can fire this once and do like 300 damage each, which is not bad, but I can, the same amount, I can fire random arrow like 3, maybe 4 times for slightly more damage total. So, I just don't need it that much.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, though, because I honestly could not remember if you could glimmer just from any old attack.
As long as it fits the right tree, yeah. I've had that happen 3 times without a light bulb so far. Nice. Mach Blade, I think Berserker, and one of the... Air Pressure. And I remember just like, okay, I'm going to mark this down because there was no light bulb and it still glimmered. And also sometimes the light bulb will appear or disappear depending on what you're fighting, if it's strong enough to raise the odds, or if you gain another skill level and suddenly you have a couple more light bulbs showing up.
Mm.
See,
I shined some light bulb in the menu. I ignored it.
Okay.
Also nice that it does show the strengths and weaknesses.
Yes. Though, also another thing you can turn off if you're nuts.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got some questions in the Discord that we want to hit up.
Sure.
Okay. There's a trend in the science fiction community in the mid-aughts where people thought it was not enough for work to be hard sci-fi. I'm already rubbing my temples. Every character must be ultra-rationalist. It ended when people realized that even if a person always acts rationally, they will still arrive at an irrational conclusion and suffer because of it. The concept of crackpot realism is a very illustrative example. Is there any game Illustrating said principle. The majority of RPG protagonists are grounded, selfless, free of bias and prejudice, and if they try hard enough, it's possible for them to learn all the information there is to learn. Most games don't intentionally hold back information to be revealed after you make the choice. Yeah, players get pissed off if you do that too much.
I remember people getting pissed off at Romancing Saga, Minstrel Song, back in the day, because it allowed you to make a wrong choice.
Yeah. There's,
I'm assuming these same people would have been really, really pissed off if they played Romancing Saga 2 and got to the volcano.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Just because I do remember some interesting conversations on the GameFX boards back in the day. It's like, are we sure there's no way to get both? And like, nope. There's no way to have your cake and eat it too in this case. And that is a feature, that is not a bug.
Oh wow, I just obliterated this poor bug. Like, overkilled by like 30,000 damage.
Why did you do this?
I wasn't trying to do it. I was trying to finish the fight. I can hear us.
Obliterate.
I was trying to find ways to advance the clock so my incantation development will finish.
Yep.
More Discord questions.
Yeah, we didn't fully answer that one. Yeah. There's a lot to this question to the point where I would need to actually spend time researching and thinking about it. So we're going to come back to that. You talked before about people not wanting to play as bastards, but if your protagonist isn't evil, just an extremely smooth operator, someone who is a walking how to win friends. While some games illustrate the benefits of a high charisma stat, NPCs are also much, much more agreeable. People are in real life. I mean, the gamification of social dynamics kind of makes that inherent. If we accept that someone is fundamentally persuadable, which is most often the case in games that allow you to that want the charisma stat to mean something, we kind of have to gamify persuasion to a degree where it's like a solvable problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's only one of the solutions, then ultimately it has to be kind of it has to be simplified. We have to accept the limits of fiction as it is on some level. Like, you can make an intractable problem, but if you're building a game where someone could theoretically make an entirely social build, and they run into someone who is literally unpersuadable, then you basically, to that player, it feels like you basically just, like, threw a middle finger straight in their face. Like, you know.
Did you ever read the webcomic Full Frontal Nerdity?
No, I did not.
It's mostly about tabletop gaming, but in one short story arc, the game master came up with a game that was basically just working the charisma stat and like all sorts of different feats for convincing people to do things to try and encourage his players to not just murder everything in sight.
Yeah.
And so they took these mechanics and they managed to talk their way into owning the entire town, enslaving half the population, just all sorts of ridiculous things because they were able to finesse all of these social feats. And then they went up against the big bad guy for the scenario. And it turns out the big bad guy of the scenario was like an 8-foot tall orcish barbarian who did not speak their language and thus could not be convinced of anything. And who simply did not care. And since they had put no points in or nothing into any form of combat ability because they were relying on their own ability to talk their way out of situations, they got slaughtered.
Whoops.
Yeah, that'll do it. Yeah, what I would say about this is that this is just sort of like a limitation of like something needing to be a functional game. Mm-hmm. Like, you can get into, you can do some really interesting things when you take non-traditional approaches to like discussion and persuasion. Like, it's almost a cliche to reference it, but Disco Elysium, relatively early on in development, allegedly, there was the intention for more traditional combat to be a major portion of the game. And ultimately, they dropped it in favor of making the dialogue more interesting, because that was both where the heart of the game lied, and it was the only way to allow that system to breathe. And so, if you play Disco Elysium, there's instead of like the way they sort of went about it was that different people were going to be persuadable by different kinds of players, and also just that fundamentally, like, persuading someone is going to at least on some level involve agreeing with them. And so you, like, how much do you want to agree with someone named Measurehead? Should I explain Measurehead?
Yes, please.
Go ahead, please.
So Measurehead inspires the game has a has a mechanic called the thought cabinet, where your character thinks of, like, gets an idea from something and then has time to sit there and sort of, like, depending upon how complex the idea they get, they have your character sits there and it takes longer to understand and, like, come to a conclusion on the thought. Measurehead gives you the thought advanced race theory. Like, Measurehead is one of the spear tips of the fascist faction of the game. He's persuadable in some contexts, but honestly, in general, like, you don't want to get too close to Measurehead unless you're a very, very sad kind of man. But yeah. It's one of those things that, like, part of how Disco Elysium works is by making it so that everyone's persuadable to someone, but, you know, that's going to depend upon what kind of person, like, your character is, and that involved them making basically every stat dialogue stat. It's just a different kind of dialogue stat, and certain dialogue stats are good for some things and bad for others. I think I've mentioned this before, but I accidentally rolled my character in Disco Elysium to be prone to hyperfixation by accident. Because his encyclopedia stat was too high. And so, like, for tons of conversations, you'll have bits where parts of your psyche are rolling dice in the background to determine whether they butt in and say something. And once they get high enough, they'll start butting in to say things that aren't relevant at all. So my encyclopedia stat got really high at one point and interrupted a completely unrelated conversation to talk about volcanoes.
Okay.
Because I guess my character had learned about volcanoes at some point and was just really excited about all the information he had about volcanoes. Fucking... Yeah. I would recommend most people at least try Disco Elysium at least once if you're interested in what you can do with a game that does not have a lot of has very little real combat, and it's all about, like, dynamics of interaction.
Actually, this description is kind of reminding me of Sovereign Syndicate, which is very much talking to people, interacting with stuff, and you have like four internal voices per character that can be stronger or weaker depending on how you react to them.
Yeah.
Also zero combat.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think. So you only have the one character stats to worry about in Disco Elysium, but you have like four basic stats, but those each feed into like six substats, six or seven.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, six. So like you have 24 stats that can all be affecting conversations at once. And if one of your stats is deranged enough, you can actually get kind of a secret 25th stat. Because right at the beginning of the game, you have to retrieve your necktie from a fucking ceiling fan. And when you retrieve it, if one of your stats speaks up and causes you to start imagining your horrible necktie talking to you, the horrible necktie also functions as like a 25th voice in your head that just sort of tells you to do things.
Okay.
Disco Elysium's an incredible game. Like, genuinely, like, it. There's nothing else quite like it.
Most of what I know about this game is just hearing about how its development team broke up and has now created four separate development teams, all claiming to be the spiritual successors.
Yeah, so that's actually what FireMiner was just asking about. Isn't it weird that there are now four upcoming games all claiming to be Disco Elysium's spiritual successors because executives drove the original studio to ruins?
Honestly, this sounds like the only appropriate way to continue Disco Elysium's legacy is by having, like, a schizophrenic break and suddenly having four separate people claiming to be the same thing.
Yeah, it's tragic what happened to the Zaum Collective, but like I'm sure, like I'd like to believe that at least one of those will be cool. I wouldn't be surprised if several of them are cool.
I just like the fact that it was like three of them declared on the same day to be making a Disco Elysium sequel, and then a fourth one chimed in a few days later.
Yep, it was wild. Let's see. Paul W.S. Anderson to write / direct a new House of the Dead film. How would a House of the Dead film even look like? Well, I'll say this much. If it doesn't have, like, really just awkward and nonsensical dialogue, I don't want to be involved with it. Like, I just want to hear, like, a horrible little monster man saying suffer like G did in a very confused sounding tone. I don't know if I'll get that, but it's what I want. But yeah, I don't like, this is one of those things that like, I don't like, you basically are just having a name to attach to what will probably otherwise be a pretty generic zombie movie. Because that's about as much value add as House of the Dead has, is like, no one cares enough about House of the Dead canon to make a big stink if you just make a generic zombie movie and call it House of the Dead.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the game's developers care enough about the game's canon.
I can't imagine anyone's too like married to the House of the Dead narrative and its sacred for us. But yeah, like I can't imagine what that film will look like, but my guess based on Paul W.S. Anderson is just kind of a subpar action sort of action horror flick. Let's see. Some people think that your characters are only as smart as yourself. While it isn't always true, there is some merit to it, and authors can do a lot to mitigate the problem. And you've got someone like Dan Brown, whose books are full of quote-unquote experts committing the fundamental sins of their profession. Well, books keep telling you that they're best, that they're the best at their jobs. What video game is the equivalent of a Dan Brown book? Honestly, a lot of video games, like, I don't even say this to be derisive, but I mean, a lot of video game stories are kind of airport novels.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, because that's, you know, a lot of, you know, a lot of books are page turners. A lot of movies are blockbusters. Like, you just sort of make something that is, and so, like, I'd say most, if we're digging down deep into, like, games that just don't examine the premises, like, again, that's going to end up being most, but, like, I'd need to be a little more specific on this. Remember, Paul W.S. Anderson's the guy who worked on the 90s Mortal Kombat movies, Resident Evil, Monster Hunter films, and Event Horizon, of all things. Yeah, no, I was including that in my assessment that it will probably be a slightly below average action film. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, like, even if we look at this from, like, in ways that are specific to video games, like, most RPGs involve, like, a largely untrained child or, like, group of children destroying what is apparently the most powerful being in the universe at some point. Like, that is almost essentially the same fundamental contradiction of, like, we're assured that this is the most powerful being in the universe, defeated by a group of sufficiently determined children. There's really, you know, that is that's hardly a peculiarity only to video games, but it is especially common in video games and RPGs for fairly obvious reasons. But yeah, I mean, like, not a lot of is Mother an airport novel? I'd say Mother is a step up from that. Mother I would describe as, like, I'm trying to think of a comparison that makes a degree of sense. But Mother is about it's on some level about nostalgia, which is a little more and ends up, like, despite being largely simple, a little more cerebral for it. It's about an examination of a lot of, like, it's about building and, like, examining some fairly, like, some fairly, like, deep in the weeds human feelings. Congrats on having your retinue be killed in battle, Wales.
I close my eyes, I swear, for like 2 seconds. I look up at the screen and I'm being obliterated by a United attack.
Good work. So people are debating on Twitter whether to call the Japanese film in question House or Houseu. How are the names of Japanese books and movies with English names? How are the names of Japanese books and movies with English names written? I mean, probably in katakana, if I were to hazard a guess.
I mean, they'll be written in katakana, but they'll also have the actual proper spelling on the front, usually.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Masquerade Hotel has Masquerade Hotel written on the front.
I like how Final Fantasy always has Final Fantasy in katakana written underneath it.
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, it won't. The assumption is that it's actually spelled the right way. So you might as well pronounce it the right way if you're actually speaking English.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the only reason, it sounds like you're making a really bad Japanese joke, and it's,
yeah, it makes you sound like you're probably racist in some fashion.
Yep.
The only justification I could see for going with, say, Houseu over House is just to make it clear what you're talking about, since House is kind of a generic name. But
Ring versus Ring.
Yeah. But even then, you're kind of on thin ice.
Yeah.
Oh, and the new trailer for Tales of Graces F Remastered said that it will include 80 DLC packs and items from the original game. And for a lot of them are just items to make the game easier, but will the collab costumes make it? Probably at least some of them. It'll probably depend upon how difficult the licensors are to work with. I don't remember what collaboration costumes are in that.
Good question.
So I'm going to go look that up to see how many of these I think are actually going to make it. Let's see. Okay, so there's ones from Tales of Vesperia. That's just going to be in there because it's like whatever, man. Let's see. Lab costumes. Let's see if I can find this. For more recent ones. Yeah, I'm having difficulty finding what these collab costumes were. If you have any of them to hand, Fireminer, that would be helpful. Anyone want to... Oh, yeah, I do want to talk a bit briefly about the Nintendo Music app. So, yeah, that was a random announcement this week. If you have Switch Online, you can use your Switch login to... log into the Nintendo Music app, which has a relatively small selection right now, but a like representative sample that seems to show promise for the future of music, a lot of Switch games, and then like some random stuff from the back catalog. Although good stuff, like, I mean, the Donkey Kong Country soundtrack is on there, and I've listened to a lot of Aquatic Ambience over the past few days. You know, as something that they can like proudly point to every month and say, "See, your subscription is worth it. Here's some more Nintendo music that we've put on the app." Like, that makes sense to them. Given that it's just free with the, like, you know, it's just part of the Switch Online subscription. Like, it's honestly not a bad value add. Like, I mean, you know, I am happy to listen to like some Splatoon music, or like I'm sure that to coincide with Chronicles X being released, they're gonna do a huge push for like, here's a bunch of Xenoblade music. I think it's a smart way for them to be able to advertise, because like, hey, if you install this on your phone and you let it have notifications, they can drop like, hey, and they can drop you a notification like, hey, in honor of this new game we're releasing, we're advertising on your phone. Hey, here's some of the music from the same franchise. Like, that makes sense. I get why they'd do that. And like, the additional question of whether it's better than just putting the tracks on Spotify. Like, I mean, it means that they can like use it as a value add for someone like me who's never gonna pay for Spotify.
Also means they can curate it better.
Yeah, and it lets them do some stuff that's like a better fit for video game music. One of the things that's been nice is that like the older music that's just supposed to loop, like you can loop it the way that it would loop in game. So like the way I would describe that is like, I'll use for an example the goal theme. And when you finish a stage in Yoshi's Island, the game has this big pomp at the start of that song. It's like da 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 da, and then it leads into the main song, da 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 da. And if you were to just loop the song normally, every time the song looped, it would go da 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 da. But you can use the app to have it loop for 15 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever. And if you tell it to loop that way instead of a timed loop rather than just looping the full breadth of the song, it loops like it does in the game, where it never does that opening after the first run. It just loops the song. It just loops the main portion of the song. And that's kind of nice, because it's like, oh, this is what it sounded like in the game. The method of organization also is kind of interesting, because it's not, like, the tracks are not alphabetically ordered. If you go to a game, the way they're organized is the order in which you would encounter them in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you'll get, like, opening tracks, and then, like, this is the track for the first level, and then this is the level complete track, and this is the bonus level track, and then 2, 3, 4, whatever, then boss track. They're sequenced in roughly the order you would run into them in a game, which can be useful because there's, like, a decent chance that you don't actually know what these songs are called. But if you remember the order the game was in, then it can be fairly easy to, like, navigate your way to the track you're looking for, because it's like, oh, well, I know it was from this area that's about this far into the game. It's kind of interesting, but, like, you know, if they were just on Spotify, they wouldn't be able to arrange the tracks in that order. So, yeah, I think they get some benefits from having control over it, and obviously they're happy to not be paying, to not have, like, anything skimmed off by Spotify, and, you know, I'm not having to listen to ads, so I'm not upset. So, honestly, I think it's a pretty nice little service. It's just, like, you know, I wouldn't, like, subscribe just for it, but, you know, I was gonna subscribe to Switch, like, even if I wasn't mooching off of Wheels' family plan, I was gonna subscribe to Switch Online one way or another anyway, and as a bonus, it's honestly pretty nice. Like, Nintendo's got a lot of great music, and as an advertising function, I wouldn't be surprised if we occasionally see some third-party tracks on there. But, yeah, like, it's, I think it's a pretty neat little, like, just a nice little bonus.
Yeah, I can see,
many...
I mean, like a little cherry on the cake, you know, just,
yeah,
it's nice.
Yeah, and I'm sure I'll get excited every time that, like, a favorite game shows up as, like, hey, we've just added the soundtrack to this game from, to Nintendo Switch, Nintendo Music. And it's like, hell yeah, I like that game. I'm gonna go listen to that soundtrack.
So, would it be, like, Nintendo exclusive games only, or just would they have songs from anything that was ever on a Nintendo?
So far they've only used their own music. I think that it wouldn't surprise me if, as part of marketing pushes, we sometimes see third-party music on there. But, you know, that's, we, there's no evidence of such a thing happening yet. I will say that one of the things I thought was kind of interesting is that in the initial batch is, like, the original Metroid, which, had a release on, it released on the NES, but it also released in Japan on the Famicom Disk System. And the Nintendo Music app includes both versions, which is nice because, you know, the NES, has, the Famicom Disk System adds an additional sound channel. So songs on an NES cartridge are going to sound inherently different from the FDS versions. So it's nice that they put both as sort of like a way of showing that that is the approach they intend to take in future, is that if there are multiple versions of a soundtrack, that they can include both.
That is nice.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, you know, it's a nice little bonus. And again, I was never going to pay for Spotify, so I'll take this over that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. How many modern games let you use your own music for the background music? Remember how big a thing that was during the PS3/PSP days? I mean, back in, like, I remember it being, like, one of the features that was touted as kind of a big deal for the original Xbox.
Yeah.
You could rip CDs to the hard drive and then replace the background music. I never really did that. Like, I just want to listen. Like,
I don't think I would... a lot of people did, which is why it never caught on as a feature. And except
yeah,
for,
like
except
it's...
for beat rhythm games.
Yeah, for rhythm games, it makes sense.
Yeah, rhythm games live off of that, but most games, I mean, even like the Gust games where they make a point of giving you the entire discography of the entire series up to this point is just because you often don't use a lot of it anyway, because the the game's got music already.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, in general,
it's one of those things, like, why bother?
Yeah. Okay. So, Fire Miner points to there being two DDR questions in the list. Look for those. Where can I find that? Okay, how can you preserve modern arcade games that are already always online and rely so much on the collectible aspect? Even the latest DDR release for Windows, which came out in 2021, doesn't contain every feature and piece of content of the arcade release at the time. And it's a subscription game, for God's sake. Man, if I knew how to, I feel like I'd be able to make, I'd be able to help a lot of people, or make a lot of people's day, or potentially make a lot of money, if I had a solution for that. It's extremely bespoke and individual to the game. Sometimes you can get away with just spoofing the endpoint server that it's looking for, but sometimes, depending upon how much they stored server side, there's going to be a lot of hacking and recreation. It's not fun. Mm-hmm.
Plus, there's the issue with copyright and trademark infringement.
Yeah, I mean,
wasn't there like a lawsuit recently where it was
effort.
The game preservation. The lawsuit that they lost. So,
yeah, I'd have to look into that.
Yeah. Basically, I think the argument was you cannot prove that the games will not be preserved and then used for entertainment purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of Bemani, the DDR company, subdivision in Konami. Has Gaijin ever seen a Bemani Pocket in Japan? It's basically an LCD rhythm game handheld.
Nope, that sounds like something that's really specific and...
Yeah, that's probably popular with a very specific subculture.
Yep.
Yeah, that feels uniquely unsuited to the idea. Let's see. Okay. I hit this because I've been thinking about this a lot recently, as has shown up on Blue Sky. The widescreen mode in some PS1 and Saturn games is not perfect 16:9, but it is widescreen nevertheless. Why was it a thing? I mean, people saw the advent of non-4:3 aspect ratios long before they came into vogue. There already talked back in the day about the future of TVs being widescreen. I mean, you have to look at the fact that, like, movie theaters were always in, like, a widescreen aspect ratio that was not 16:9. But, you know, like, it was definitely a wide aspect ratio. And... so, in the effort to, you know, be more like that higher quality viewing experience that people would go out to see, inevitably, like, the future of TVs being widescreen. Bear in mind, also, the earliest HD test broadcasts were in Japan in, like, 1993. The Hi-Muse... It's actually, okay, so yeah. The Japan began broadcasting analog HDTV signals in 1988.
Yikes. Initially
with an aspect ratio of 2:1.
Impressive.
Yeah, by the early 90s, digital HDTV, like the standard that we currently use now, was already in development. Like, if you cared about this sort of thing, it was possible to be aware that this was on the horizon as, like, this is the future of what television will be like. And
eventually.
And some people were trying to experiment with that before it became standard. And again, in Japan, there was an HD Laserdisc player in 1994. It cost thousands of dollars and broke constantly.
Yep.
But if you somehow had a $10,000 HD TV that was designed to broadcast, that was designed for signals of 1035i, you could get like fucking HD Terminator 2 on your high vision HD your high vision HD Laserdisc player. There's also some some other weird offshoot formats that you've basically never heard of or used that were designed with this eventuality in mind as well. There's actually an update of the VHS standard from 1993 called WVHS. Was a VHS meant to be able to record these like early test HD broadcasts in Japan. So yeah, people knew that this was coming. This was a known thing that was in development.
There's always a case of the actual support systems catching up with the concept of technology.
Yeah, and of course the other thing you have to think about is, like, with game developers, a lot of people, especially programmers in game development, like doing weird experiments, like trying to use new technology. Programmers love that shit. Honestly, mm-hmm. if you're keeping track, if you're the person in charge of the project, like, there is a point where you kind of have to tell the people working on your technology, like, I know that you're really interested in this, like, programming technique or, like, lighting technique, technology, whatever. This isn't the time or place to use it. Yeah. But, yeah. And so, you know, if someone is, like, doing experiments with, like, you know, I want to make a widescreen PS1 game, like, sure, you go ahead and do that as long as it's, like, as long as you're getting your other work done. So it shows up in a few games. The transition to widescreen display happened to PC in the early 2000s with high-end laptops first, though some of them went with 5x4 instead of 16x9. You also started seeing some PC games with the 1280x768 option, but when did you personally transition to widescreen PC gaming? I was not a PC gamer until widescreen was already a major thing.
I'm honestly not sure if I have transitioned at any point. I'm not much of a PC gamer to begin with.
Mm-hmm. When I play, like, when I started, like, I don't play majority PC, but when I started playing on PC, it was the widescreen transition had already happened. Wheels is the only one who might have a story about this, but I think is busy trying not to get his ass beat.
I'm also trying to stay awake. I'm very tired.
Yeah, we should probably shut this down soon.
Yeah. What was the question? Sorry.
So Firewriter was asking when we each, like, what our first, like, computers were that had a widescreen display.
Oh, probably a laptop, to be honest.
Yeah, he brought that up.
Yeah.
That, like, laptops were earlier. Did you have some sort of widescreen MacBook early on, Wheels?
No, it's just a regular old MacBook, but I think they all just came, like...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, do you remember around what year that would have been?
I could probably look it up. It was a specific model. It was like the second model of the iBook, the Jobs edition. I was thinking, Jobs edition. They didn't have iBooks before Jobs. It's one of the early iBook models, so probably find the
year. Yeah, some of the early iBooks were like... The earliest iBooks are like 1999.
Yeah, it may have been then. It was before I started college. No, it was not an aluminum G4 Firefly. It was.
I'm gonna assume was it a nice G3 clamshell?
I have an aluminum Intel MacBook. Damn. I did not have one way back then. No.
You were but a suffering college student.
Yeah.
That's a nice FireWire port. Remember when the PS2 had a FireWire port?
Did it?
Yeah. It's a FireWire port.
FireWire was like, instead of using like USB, like for a long time, Macs would favor FireWire as their sort of like standard connector. It's a slightly different standard. That's about all that matters here. it doesn't work in the same way. Technically, FireWire was just Apple's like proprietary name for what is officially the IEEE 1394 interface. But realistically, like they were the only ones to ever try to make something happen with that interface. So like by default, like, you know, technically what Sony put on the PS2 was not officially a FireWire port, but it was the FireWire standard. Sony's brand name for it was iLink, which ironically sounds like something that ironically, iLink sounds more like something that Apple would have called it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was basically like in terms of purpose, it's not similar to USB. Never had the same take up by any stretch. Went away sometime in the aughts. I don't know when Apple officially got rid of it. Like, I think there was a period where Apple computers would have both FireWire and USB ports.
I believe that.
Does that sound right, Wales?
Yes, it sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so... they definitely did, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Officially, there are still kind of like it for a long time. There were attempts to keep this port being like keep making advances on this port, but I think they've finally died. Yeah, being as Wheels is slowly dying on the vine, I think now is probably a good time for us to go to bed. So let's start. Yeah. Talking about things that we can read.
Yay! So if you need a bedtime story this upcoming fall season, we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor for Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. I've actually had quite a lot of reading on Kindle Unlimited the past 2 months. It's been kind of nice. Or at the very least, I've had at least two people reading a lot of stuff on Kindle Unlimited. So keep up the good work, everybody. Please read more. Let me know what you think. So the gist is, if you enjoy tabletop gaming, if you enjoy reading about other people doing tabletop gaming, because that's a, you know, it's a thing. It's, if you'd like to do, if you'd like this experience while also avoiding YouTube, we have a good deal here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And plus, you can read faster than you can listen to videos, so there's always that too.
And it's true.
Yes. Yeah, quite true. So yes, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. And if you want more bedtime story types, we have Tanuki as a Teapot, Animal Tales of Japan, which, again, it's mostly retellings of Japanese folk tales involving animals. So... fewer deaths than you would imagine, so, but you know how it is.
it's folklore. The fewer does not mean zero.
Oh yeah, I mean, my wife and I were visiting her host family in Florida many years ago, and we were telling bedtime stories, and the kids finally requested one where none of the animals died, and we were like, "Give us a moment here to think of one."
we're gonna have to work at this. This is gonna take some work.
Yeah. I mean, it's not quite that bad, but I did have to put a disclaimer at the start of the book saying no animals were harmed in the writing of this book, but quite a few were harmed in the telling of it.
Yeah, so. That's definitely one of those, like, you know, be careful about what you're about to read / you know, just be aware of what you're getting into.
Yeah. Fun stories.
Yeah. If you enjoy folklore, there's a rich vein to be tapped. So yeah, give that a look. Kindle, Kindle Unlimited, Amazon, Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu.
Yes.
Let's see. Joe's not here, but I would be remiss if we did not bring up that you can check out his YouTube channel at Smokin' Joe Gamer. Let's see, where, honestly, the last of the Spooky Hollow stream stuff should probably be going up, earlier today. Or perhaps in the days to come, but yeah, spooky times are over. As for us, you can catch us Thursdays at midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific. If you catch us while we're streaming, you can ask us questions there, or you can ask us questions in the comments section under this very episode at RP Gamer. I should have checked. I will check next week, I promise. Or you can ask us questions in the RP Gamer Discord, which you can get to by going to rpgamer.com and clicking on community to find an invite. Even if you don't want to ask us questions, it's a nice community that loves talking about RPGs. If you're here, there's a statistically high chance that you enjoy video game RPGs. But but yeah, so give that a look. We also have our sister show Shenanigans on Sunday night, where me, Wheels, and Joe are varying degrees of grumpy and potentially playing the same game, but sometimes not. That's at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. Otherwise, I think that's about it. Thanks once again to Fireminer for providing our questions. It's good to see you, Just Burgundy, and Joe in the chat. Hopefully we can get Joe back in the podcast one of these weeks when he's not scared of being spoiled. But otherwise, I think that wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See ya.
See you.